Bum, 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 bum. It went to recording instantly. Okay, good. Let's go. Am I going to get bandwidth warnings if I switch the video? I'm looking good. I'm going to start talking before my internet connection decides to give up on me. That is what I'm going to do. Let's go. For the fourth time tonight, there is a projects section. There's a project section in the monthly Judge magazine. If you want to send out like a call for action, if you want to advertise a project you're working on, you want to get help from other judges on that, then let us know. The knowledge pool, creative fun ideas, and the flashcard project, as well as the wiki content for tournament operations that I mentioned over in the first part of the stream, they're all looking for help. So, knowledge pool, David de la Iglesia is your person to contact. What the knowledge pool does is it puts out situations for normally L1 judges to discuss, come up with solutions for, and give you like an answer. Hopefully, give you an answer at the end. They're looking for two or three level 2+ judges that you need to be fluent in English. And you need to be able to participate in replying to discussions over email, something like 2 to 3 times a week. David de la Iglesia is your guy for that one. Richard Drivers is the guy to contact if you're interested in the creative fun ideas section of the Judge Wiki. There is a project description here. I don't know what that's about, so I'm going to click on the project description and I'm going to find out once that loads. There's a flashcard project that's looking for one or two more people in the short term to help with finishing touches of the comprehensive rules of flashcards. That's looking to be quite an interesting study aid. And Ryan Stapleton is the person that you need to speak to if you want to help out with that. I'm looking at the project description for Creative Fun Ideas. It says, "We're all aware of how much hard work needs to be done during large events. At the end of the day, most judges just leave the venue and turn to bed. Some of these judges would rather do something else, but are not familiar enough with the environment and/or the other judges working the event to take the initiative themselves. That's why this project exists. That's Richard Drivers you need to speak to if you want to get involved and flesh that out a bit." I mentioned the first part about the wiki content that had been updated, deck checks, going to your first GP, that kind of thing. They're looking for feedback on those things. So, if any of the created content has been useful to you, we'd like to know. And by we, I mean Jürgen Bert and Michael Weiser are looking for the specific feedback on this. Did you learn anything by looking at the wiki? Did you pass pages on to your local judge candidates to read? Did you like the discussion on the mailing list? Do you have any ideas to improve the project? Do you have any topics that you would like to be covered? Have any of those things stir up a response in you, then please do get in touch with Jürgen or Michael on that one. Okay, hooray! I got the project section done without disconnecting from Ustream. Woot! Right, community and program. So we have a lovely judge community, and we like to celebrate it whenever we can. So here are some things that that have been pointed out over the course of March about the judge community. So Johanna Vertanen runs a project where she keeps track of judge anniversaries, and she's put together a whole list of the judges who have now, as of March, been with us for either 10 or 5 years. Featured veteran for the month is Daniel. The name spelled OJCIUS. I don't know how to pronounce that. Ocious? Okius, Ojkius, I don't know, but he's the featured veteran for the month. And so, if you want to find out more about him, you can click that link. It'll take you into DCI family, I think. And Wern Chong has been a level 3 for many years and got his anniversary update. We also have two lots of judge advancement updates. We had the February update and the March update because it came that February update was slightly delayed. We got them both in the same month. In February, we had 96 new L1s. This is worldwide, and 18 new L2s, which is amazing. And there was a new level 3 in Europe, which I think that was Kaya. I think that was Kaya Fedarovic. Then for March, we had another 103 new L1s, 25 new L2s. and 1L3. This time it was Kim Warren, and I had great fun writing her bio for that, which came through largely unedited, I think. I hope she didn't mind. Once again, she's not here for me to congratulate her on attaining level 3, but yeah, well, anyway. Speaking of level 3, if you're interested in applying for level 3, you need to have judged a certain number of events. I think it's 20 competitive events or something like that, which is slightly tricky to prove at the moment because the My Events functionality on the Wizards website has disappeared for a bit. And it's likely to be down for a while. I think it's actually it's being replaced or something. I don't know. Something to do with Planeswalker points is making this bit kind of go away. So, if you're confident you met the event requirements, just go ahead. You don't need to supply like documentary evidence of it. We'll soon work out whether you've judged the correct number of events or not. Andy Hecht posted to say, well, with the advent of the L3 checklist, there are a lot of L2s about who are seeking to be a team leader. I've also been reminded in the chat that Eric Sorensen at WotC is the contact that you need for determining exactly how many events you have judged if you're not sure whether you meet certain requirements. Andy has instructed Grand Prix head judges to only use half of their team leader slots on Sunday for L2s because, as he sees it, and I have to agree, level 3s need to lead by example on the Sunday. So we need team leader positions to be filled by level 3s because, well, they got promoted to level 3 because this is what they're good at. This is their chance to shine. And by there, I mean mine, because I'm also a level 3. And you know, we do get the day one team leader slots as well. I know that. But yeah, if you're a level 2 looking to team lead on a Sunday, don't get disappointed if it takes a while for you to get that slot. We're targeting at people who are getting towards the end of their checklist and need it as one of the like, final requirements they need to in order to get an L3 interview. So. If you do have any questions, then ask away. Andy is very contactable. He will reply to emails, or just post on the list and he'll reply kind of in public, as it were. Okay, I mentioned the L1 test earlier, and one of the reasons I said I was coming back to it is because I knew this section was coming up. Brian Schenk is apparently the DCIX manager. He manages the content for the Level 1 certification test. And he would like to remind people of a few things. That the policy section for level one, it includes the judging at regular document and MTR sections 210, sorry, 2 and 10 and Appendix B. Now, I told you about 2 and 10 earlier in the stream, but I didn't cover what Appendix B was. I'm trying to find it now. Oh, time limits. So, this is the bit that tells you. What time limits are recommended, and does it is it all just recommended ones? Yeah, it's recommended timings for the amount of time in a round, the amount of time to use for deck registration in certain sealed events, and so on. And there will be questions. There are questions on this in the level one test, so it's worth knowing. You get yourself a few practically free percentage points on your certification exam. If you know those, triggered abilities are very popular lately, and it's important to know how to handle them correctly. It's a little bit tongue in cheek because, obviously, with them changing quite so much, I imagine some of those questions will need to be updated with the new IPG. But yeah, you do need to know how to handle them correctly. The combat phase appears to be difficult to many people. Deep knowledge of layers is not required, but it is important. To be able to determine at least how power and toughness effects interact. Now, I'm aware I haven't covered layers on this stream before, but combat phase I definitely have, and triggered abilities I definitely have. So just by watching this stream, you should be very well prepared for the level one test as it is. I also haven't covered the judging at regular document. That's going to be my first port of call for a policy stream once I get to policy. But as you can imagine, I'm basically concentrating on the rules right now. When we do get to policy, the jar is my first port of call. Full reading of the comprehensive rules isn't required for level one. You can get by without ever having actually read the document. I think it's good that you should know that it exists and you should be able to search it at least. If not through using rules.wizards.com, through any other means, you should have that familiarity with the document to be able to find what you're looking for. And it is suggested that you take at least 3 easy practice exams before testing. You heard it from the man himself. Somebody, Michael Swager, posted to the list because as a level one judge, he was approached by an uncertified judge or somebody who wanted to join the program and become a level one judge. And he wasn't really sure if it was his place to really mentor an uncertified judge, as he's only a level one, whereas of course level two is required for certification. You need level two to actually run the certification test. But of course you're invited to help grow your local community. If you're a level one judge and there's someone near you who's interested in judging, well, talk to them about why you like judging. Get them to take a rules advisor test or something along those lines, and have a chat about the issues that they find with it. You shouldn't share specific question content, mainly because I don't actually know if there's any overlap with the rules advisor questions and potential like level one or even level two rules questions. I don't know. So I know that the advice is generally not to share specific question content. But you can certainly easily go, what kind of things did you get wrong? I got triggers wrong. I'm a bit confused as to how this worked. And any judge candidate who's like worth their salt should be able to take the specific question away and just rephrase their question in terms of what it is they don't understand about that thing. Anyone should be able to do that. It's quite simple. A couple of simple reminders were also on the list. One was about sharing location information about events. In general, if you know the location of an event but it's not been shared on the main website yet, it's not public. Even if it is communicated to judges, it might not be public. If it's not public, it might change. So it's better to not share it until a fact sheet for an event has been published. If you do have somebody who takes a rules advisor test, takes and passes a rules advisor test, then you need to submit feedback in the judge centre with the DCI number of that person and the ID of the exam in order for their rules advisor membership to actually be activated. Now you need the rules advisor membership to actually see the DCI Judge L mailing list. No, I'm wrong. The MTG Rules L mailing list. And also to create level one practice exams, I think. So for both of those, if you know somebody's passed their rules advisor, you have to be aware that the membership is not being updated automatically and you need to submit feedback to make it happen. New judge levels are manually being updated by Eric Sorensen. It normally takes about 2 weeks, but if you don't get a response, if you don't get any new judge level within like 2 weeks of a passing test, you should contact Eric Sorensen and check that hasn't slipped through the cracks. And also, I don't exactly know why, but the year is stuck on 2010. You can't, at the moment, submit a review for a year other than 2010. So if you need to highlight it, put this is a 2012 review in one of the fields of the review, and you'll be fine. Finally, if you come up with interesting questions that might be of use to the judge centre or to the judge booth. So the judge centre, I mean certification questions, things that are useful for actually becoming part of the level one test, for instance. And by the judge booth, I mean the thing that runs at most GPs these days, where a couple of judges, like they take on members of the public with some rules questions, and those who perform really well might like get to take a foil home or something. There's a nice, fun little interaction with the judge community there. But obviously you need questions to keep going. There was a question that said, well, if I come up with some questions, should I submit it to the judge centre for a certification? Or should I submit it to the judge booth, the help over there? Or what should I do? The judge centre needs your questions. They're slightly harder to come up with because you need to come up with 5 answers. You need a correct answer and 4 detracting wrong answers for it. Ideal questions are usually about newer keywords and cards. They concentrate on cards and standard. They're direct and to the point and very specific. If you can come up with those questions, submit them to the judge centre, we can improve our level one question pool and ultimately make the certification process go a lot more smoothly. So yeah, go for that. I'm being reminded in the chat that it's important for yourself to maintain your own Rules Advisor membership status, because you cannot make level one practice tests for other people unless you are a Rules Advisor, which is interesting. The judges aren't automatically Rules Advisors. You need to maintain that if you possibly can. Okay, let's move on to the policy discussions. In fact, let's skim over the events that happened in March. I'm not going to give any of these a great deal of time. I'm just going to mention there were a lot of GPs that happened in March. What we've got in the Judge magazine is links to the coverage of each of the GPs, the judge list together with photos, some text from the head judges, in the case where there's two, and from the regional coordinator, and like shout outs to people who have moved across to, like, travelled the globe in order to get to the GPs. In March, there was GP Lille, Seattle, Indianapolis, Nashville, Kuala Lumpur, Mexico City, Melbourne, Salt Lake City, Turin. That was quite a lot of GPs for 1 month. In April, all we've got listed is Manchester. Is that because it is the only GP in April, or just no one else has got back with information? I'm not entirely sure. Why were there so many GPs in March and not many in April? I suppose we're going to have the pre-release for Avatar Restored at the end of the month. Maybe it was just a weird gap in the scheduling. Oh, also, April includes the WMCQ week, the first WMCQ weekend. So, yeah, there's a big gap. Never mind. Hey, I thought March felt a bit busy. There we go. So that was my little shout out for the events. I'm not going to go into any detail, but if you want more detail on any of those events, look up the monthly Judge magazine and see them. Okay, now, for me, one of the main drivers, main reasons for DCI Judge L to exist is for us to discuss policy, tournament operations, rules, things like that, and just say, this happened, what should I do? So I'll give a brief rundown of the things that came up here. I'm being told in the chat the reason for there being like nothing happening in April is because there's GP Manchester, and GP Manchester is going to be the epic. Yes, yes it is. Totally epic. Really looking forward to it. Hopefully see you there. If anybody watching this stream is going to be there, especially if I've like never met you before or something, find me, come up to me, and just go, boom. I love watching your stream. Or even, I hate watching your stream because like your voice is really annoying, but for some reason I just can't stop tuning in every week. Tell me something. And even if I know you, and especially if I haven't seen you for a while, but even if I see you every single week, come up to me in Manchester and let me know how I'm doing, how you're doing. Just talk to me. I love talking to people. Better than talking just straight to a computer. I really hope there's a good regional coordinator in Manchester. It's me. Anyway, let's get on with policy and tournament operations. These are kind of the questions that that came up over the last month on the mailing list, and I believe we've got answers for all of them, but if not, they might be good discussion points. So, Sealed Deck Grand Prix Trials. What happens at Sealed Deck Grand Prix Trials? Well, there's been some confusion and limited Grand Prix trials as to when and where there should be a cut to top four instead of top eight. Because in the MTR, in the Magic Tournament rules, a GP trial says you can cut to top four instead of top eight if you run an extra Swiss round. In fact, I don't think that's specific for GP trials. It just says that events can be run to a top four instead of a top eight if you include an extra round of Swiss to make up for that. However, the fact sheet for a tournament will supersede this. And in this case, for GP trials, it says that in any limited GP trial, you should always cut to top eight. And then there's a reminder that that top eight can be sealed using the same decks as the Swiss section of the Grand Prix trial, or it can be a draft in its own right, but it's always a top eight. Obviously, that's subject to change in the future. You should always check the fact sheet for the GP trial that you're particularly running. But for now, whilst in constructed, you with between 9 and 16 players, you will actually cut to top four Even with a 9-16 player Grand Prix trial, yes, even with a 9-player Grand Prix trial that's being run in the limited format, you will cut to top 8. 4 rounds to drop a player. It's quite harsh, but what can you do? Eric Shukan brought up a fair bit to do with drafting double face cards. Double face cards, for anyone living in a hole, look a little bit like this. They've got the sun logo on the front side, but they don't have an ordinary magic pack. They have something else on the other side. That makes it interesting for drafting because obviously you can see the other side of the card. So there isn't an official policy for when players are allowed to look at double face cards during drafting. However, I'll note that I think a lot of people have ended up being disqualified from drafts by looking to either side to kind of see what other players are doing, which you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to look at what cards the player next to you is drafting. But this is all rendered a little bit tricky by the fact that they could have double face cards like in their pile of drafted cards, and players have been saying, "Yeah, but I was just trying to look at what the double face card was that they drafted," and they end up being disqualified because there being significant doubt as to whether they were using that as an excuse or what. So, some good ideas that came up with this were to instruct the players at the start of the pack to reveal all the double face cards. Go, look, I've got this one. Here it is. Give them time to look at the other cards, and then get on with the draft. It doesn't cost you very long, and it does help. You could allow an additional, say, 5 seconds in between each pick to say, so draft a card, pass your 10 cards to the player on your left, check for double face cards, pick up your 10 cards or something like that. This gives you like a 5 second window on every pick to look for the double face cards, and then you know once all the packs are picked up and they're in front of the players that there's no shady peeking going on. So yeah, this was only brought up, I think, because there were a fair few disqualifications that happen in draft events because of this, and it's a little unfortunate, really. Having said that, once we get to Avacyn Restored and Avacyn Restored's drafted by itself, we might, which doesn't have any double face cards in it, then we might be out of that particular logistical nightmare. But yeah, whilst you're still running Innistrad and Dark Ascension drafts, especially in any kind of competitive environment, it's worthwhile thinking to yourself, how will I tackle the problem of players appearing to peek at each other's cards? Charlotte had her own question about this card here, Misdirection. We're a bit worried about coaching players. The question was raised about misdirection being played incorrectly. So, misdirection changes a spell's target, and someone maybe tries to play misdirection to force a counterspell that's on the stack to target misdirection instead. So that which is correct. What you can't do is make a counterspell target itself. But something that's important to note about misdirection, despite the fact that it has the word target all over it, in the Oracle text, I believe it's only 3 times. Misdirection targets a spell, so when you cast misdirection, you have to declare what it is going to target, and it can only target a spell that has a single target. So there's your second instance of the word target. The fact you're going to change target doesn't actually happen until resolution. So you don't need to announce at the point that you cast misdirection that what you are going to change the target to. It's players will commonly do this as a kind of a shortcut anyway. They'll go, "Oh, misdirect your thing to that." But they don't need to. It doesn't happen till resolution. Now, because the player's already made the choice of casting misdirection, targeting the counterspell, when they go to resolve it, if they say, "Make your counterspell target itself," you can go, "Well, no, you can't do that." And even if you were to decide they'd committed a game rule violation, casting the misdirection was not illegal at all. It's only become illegal at the point of trying to resolve it. They're trying to resolve it by illegally making a spell target itself, which can't be done. So it's okay, even if you were to consider like backing up, you'd only back up to the resolution of misdirection anyway. So you could go, "Okay, no, you can't make a spell target itself. You can target anything on the stack." And you you don't really have a choice then other than to target misdirection. So whilst it might feel a little bit like coaching because you're getting a player who doesn't really know how to do what they're trying to do to the right kind of final end point, it's not really coaching because they've already made the decision. They've committed to the play of casting misdirection at this point. They just don't technically know how it works. So I think it's fine to help them on at that point. In a similar light, someone asked about intervening in a competitive rail tournament because he saw this happen. A player cast Intangible Virtue. Now, he's got some 1-1 tokens out. So after Intangible Virtue is resolved, they're going to be 2-2 tokens. And he noticed that the opponent had Fume Spitter in play. Now, the right play, strategically, is probably to sacrifice the Fume Spitter, aiming at one of the 1-1s, whilst Intangible Virtue is still on the stack. Resolve the ability, it will kill a token. Instead, what he saw happen here was that the player had played Intangible Virtue and then declared attackers without really pausing for breath. And what the other guy then did was he used the Fume Spitter to block one of the now 2-2 tokens and made definitely a subpar play. And he felt that this was because the first player had maybe rushed a little bit. But no infractions occurred. Nothing illegal has happened. So unless there's like more to this situation, there's no need for a judge to intervene. I will say that at regular rules enforcement level, it would be quite nice maybe after the match, like in between rounds, to go, did you know you can do this? With the Intangible Virtue on the stack, you can activate the Fume Spitter and kill that 1-1. Because they might not know it's a possibility. Or they might know it's a possibility, but not realise that they're allowed to interrupt an opponent who's gone quite quickly through their main phase. They might not realise they're allowed to go, wait, go back. I want to do this whilst Intangible Virtue is still on the stack. So from a customer service viewpoint, at regular rules enforcement level, I would rather say to the players, did you know you could do this? But very, very clearly do this outside of a match so that you're not coaching at that point. What else came up? Arena and committing to an action. This is an interesting discussion topic involving this card, Arena, which lets you tap a creature that you control and a creature that an opponent controls, but crucially, of their choice, they choose the other creature, and they're going to deal damage to each other. So it's like a precursor to fighting before Fight came out in Innistrad. If a player went, I want my knight to fight your Goyf. He hasn't technically chosen the target. He's just said something out loud. He said, I want this to happen. I'd love it if you chose the Goyf. And what the other player did was they picked up the Goyf and went to put it in the graveyard and then went, hang on, wait, don't I get to choose the target? So there's two things going on. One is, having picked up the Goyf and motioned towards the graveyard, have you accepted that the ability is resolved and have you got any opportunity to go back? I'd say yes, you can go back at that point. The fact that you've picked up the Goyf and gone to put it in the graveyard, I don't think has committed your... you're not committed to that action. Especially given the first part that he's gone, I want my knight to fight your Goyf, and tried to kind of mislead you into doing the wrong thing. Technically speaking, there's nothing wrong with saying, I want my knight to fight your Goyf. Now, the thing is, if both players are particularly well-versed in English, I don't think there's going to be a problem here. I haven't actually implied that I am targeting your Goyf, and I have still left the choice up to you because, well, I haven't said that I'm targeting the Goyf. Of course, I can't say that, especially having judged at some recent European GPs. I can't say that both players are perfectly good English speakers. I'm a little dubious about this play. I want to fight the Goyf, but I'm not technically targeting it. I'm just hoping that you don't realise what my card does. It's very shady. Very, very shady indeed. So with that, I would definitely not hold the opponent as having committed to targeting the Goyf when he then goes, wait, hang on, I thought I got to choose the target. Let's move on. Someone asked, is this collusion? A player asks his opponent to concede. Will you concede? The concession's refused. Then he says, well, okay, how about we have a prize split? We'll split prizes this way, blah, 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 blah. Now will you concede? Is this collusion slash bribery? Yes, it is. Player A in this point should definitely receive a DQ for that. It's very thinly veiled bribery, which basically makes it bribery. Player B should call a judge immediately. If they don't, they could potentially be DQ'd as well. Even if they haven't accepted the bribe, they should call a judge immediately. Now, some players don't actually realise this, and it's entirely possible for a player who doesn't call a judge immediately to not receive a DQ, but they, it's, but according to the wording, the letter of the IPG, if you don't call a judge immediately, you do stand to be disqualified yourself. So, your opponent tries to bribe you, tell a judge straight away, IPG says to him. We had a lot of questions about smartphones in tournaments, but with the MTR having been updated to say exactly when electronic devices are allowed, then this question kind of fell by the wayside a bit. But you should know that the MTR has been updated, and well, electronic devices, they're kind of allowed now. Tardiness at competitive rail. Someone had a question. If there are lots of players who are late at the beginning of a round, let's get rid of arena, it's a bit distracting now. If there's lots of players who are late at the beginning of a round of a competitive event, well, that doesn't mean we should delay the tournament. They may have a perfectly good reason why they weren't there on time, but the bottom line remains that they should communicate to you that they need time and that they could be late. So yeah, if a load of people are late, well, you just start the round, and if you end up giving out loads of tiredness penalties, then well, that is gonna happen. Of course, what you should do is you should start the round and then leave the question about tiredness penalties until it comes up. If you have like 10 players missing, and suddenly all 10 players turn up at once, and there was a good reason why none of them were on time for the round, then you don't have to give out the game losses at that point. What you shouldn't do is look at the tournament and go, oh my God, 10 players are missing, what on earth can I do? And not start the round. You should just go on, get on with it, and you know, sort out the mess later. The players who are there will definitely appreciate the round actually beginning. On the other hand, having said that, I did give you exactly the opposite advice last week. Because in a standard side event I was running in Turin, something like half the players couldn't turn up. Now, when I say half the players, I'm talking about 50% of like a 130 player tournament. So I think 65 players not being there at the beginning of event, because I couldn't get to a microphone to actually make the beginning of event announcement, I think that's a perfectly good reason not to begin the event, because trying to sort out 65 tardiness decisions is difficult enough. If we're talking about 10 players or something that aren't there, it's a significant clump, but the tournament can carry on, then I think you probably should carry on. Unless you have a very good reason not to, which I think I did. Does winking work on the stream? I'm not going to wink again. I feel a little bit like, what's the name off The Weakest Link? Okay. A whole bunch more. Policy wants to do. Am I going to get through these? Yeah, let's drive through. Let's do it. Come on, we can do this. Few policy questions. Who brought up policy questions? These are questions about how far should you go to help and educate players at regular rail. So there were a lot of questions on similar themes. Ooh, I don't want Trinisphere. I want Thalia. So let's say a player asks us, if I've got two Thalias on the battlefield. Then will the two effects add up? So Thalia says non-creature spells cost one more to cast, and the question they're asking is if I've got two out, will non-creature spells cost two more to cast? And the question in this judge's head is, how on earth are you going to get two out? Because they're legendary. Not really going to happen. Worthwhile pointing out that at regular rail, there's no such thing as derived information. There's only free information and private information. And judges are told in the MTR not to assist with derived information, but instead free anything that's free, they are allowed to help with, which at regular rel means everything that's not private. So that means you should do something to at least hint that having two Thalias in play is pretty difficult. I mention that the virtual game state idea here, I think. So this is the idea that even at competitive rules enforcement level, where there are certain questions where you can't answer because you would be dishing out derived information which you shouldn't be doing, there's this idea of the virtual game state, whereby the player describes to you precisely the game state they're asking a question about, and you answer in this hypothetical game state. You can answer a lot more than you can about the game state that's in play in front of you. So to give you an example, if I ask how big is this Tarmogoyf, then I'm not going to get an answer to that at a competitive rel. There's many reasons why. Now, to do with, you might not have noticed like what's in play. There might be a Glorious Anthem in play, which is giving the Tarmogoyf +1/+1. There might have been a trigger that resolved earlier in the turn that your opponent doesn't want to bring any attention to. So if I say, how big is this Tarmogoyf right now? The judge isn't going to be able to tell me. But if I said, if I've got a Tarmogoyf in play and a Glorious Anthem in play, and the only card types in... I've got an instant in my graveyard, and there's a creature in my opponent's graveyard, and there's nothing else, then how big is the Tarmogoyf? Then the judge can definitely say that it's a 3-4, and they can explain, because there's two card types in all graveyards, because Tarmogoyf does count all graveyards, and that because of the interaction with layers, then, you know, Glorious Anthem will apply afterwards, and you will end up with a 3-4. So the main difference between how big is this Tarmogoyf right here and how big is this hypothetical Tarmogoyf in this situation is you put the onus on the player to describe the situation, and you only answer the question based on what they've described. So applying that to this situation, I would say, if someone asks me, if there are two Thalias in play, will non-creature spells, will the effects add up? I think I'm actually quite comfortable in saying, if there are two Thalias in play, I definitely at regular rel, I'm saying, like, it's very difficult to get two Thalias in play. Normally, you can't get two Thalias in play because they're legendary. I'd be just very explicit about that. Even at competitive rel, I think I would probably say something like, if you somehow had two Thalias in play, then yes, the abilities would stack. Maybe I'd leave it at that, I don't know. There was also a question about life totals. What happens if you get called over and there's a discrepancy on life totals? One player believes their life total to be something, the other player believes their life total to be something else. Well, the fact is, it's very difficult to walk away from that table with everybody happy. It's just not going to happen. But as long as you explain your reasoning for getting to the ruling that you get to, then neither player should feel cheated by the judge. And yeah, you don't apologise, because it's their mess that you're coming in to sort out. They made a mistake somewhere along the line that you're just trying to help them with. So there's no need to apologise for the fact that you can't come up conclusively with an answer to what the current life total is. But you make a decision and you go with it. So look, I believe the fairest outcome here, the outcome that I believe is most likely given the actions that I know about, given what I can see on there, what I can see on the life pads, has been marking, the cards I can see in the graveyard, I believe the life totals are this and this. Carry on. If a player particularly agrees with that, it'll probably be appealed. But then if you went to a good effort to take into account all the information that's available to you, then the head judge is almost certainly not going to overturn you. It happened to me in like the third or fourth round of World Championships I was judging at, exactly this kind of thing. There was a one point discrepancy in the life totals, and it mattered hugely because one player thought they were on 11, the other player thought that player was on 12, and somebody was attacking for 11. Obviously, that's a crucial life point at that point. There's no easy way out of it, but just make the decision and stick to it. Simultaneous. Well, I'm kind of freewheeling now because I haven't read this far before I started the stream. So apologies if this is a little loosely held together. So we get to a PTQ, two players reach the final. Neither of them wants the travel award or the invitation. They both want the second place prize, which is cash or product or something. So both of them want to try to concede. Huh, that's interesting. Some people have suggested that they play out the match with the winner getting the right to concede and get take second place or something. They can split the two. They could split the second place prize, and neither player getting the first prize or something. It's a bit weird. What you can't do, what you absolutely cannot do, is convert the travel award or the invite. They can't be converted into a cash value. It just can't be done. We often make people, we suggest that people drop from the top eight if they're not actually interested in winning the invitation for exactly this reason. And the way this is often done is by awarding your booster prizes, your cash prizes, whatever prizes other than the invitation. If you award all of those based on the Swiss standings, then the entire top eight is being played out purely for the invitation. So like a loss in the semi-final is actually no different to a loss in the quarter-final, then we're fine. A lot of TOs like this system. It means you don't get into this problem where you've got two players in a PTQ final, neither of which can actually make the event. It's a bit awkward. I'm going to move on to... when should you call a judge a competitive and professional? What if somebody is playing a deck which lends itself to the opponent making lots of game rule violations? So someone noticed they play this deck and they've got a lot of cards in it that the opponents tend to get wrong. Do I, as a player of this complicated deck, have a responsibility to remind you how to play properly? And we seem to be in general agreement with this. No, I'm not under any responsibility to make you play it properly. And if I chant you, if I play orange chant, meaning that you can't, and I kick it, meaning that you can't play spell this turn and you can't attack this turn, and then later in the turn you try to attack, then I'm perfectly justified in calling a judge and saying, judge, I cast orange chant kicker and my opponent just tried to attack. They'll rack up warnings, and if the warnings stack up enough, they'll lead to game losses. But that's not my responsibility at all. If you break the rules, I should be calling a judge, even if I'm playing a particularly tricky deck that should make you make lots of mistakes. Last couple of things, very niche bits here. Does the Hall of Fame, do players in the Hall of Fame get a club level in organised play? Well, for the 2012 Pro Club, then the Hall of Fame members are at least level 5 and they will get those benefits until the end of 2012. Then for the Pro Club going into 2013, which has silver, gold and platinum levels, then Hall of Fame members don't have a Pro Club level itself. There's no like direct mapping between the two, but they have their own benefits, which are largely parallel to gold. They're pretty much the same. And that will begin after Pro Tour Avacyn Restored, which is in Barcelona soon, in May, I think. And I'll be there. Finally, updates on disqualification cases and some disqualification reporting tips. If you do have to disqualify somebody and you need to report the DQ, please give the player you're disqualifying an opportunity to write a statement. And if they refuse to write a statement, you should mention that in your report. It's important. You should also write your own statement of events, and ideally you should write your statement before you've read the statement that the player has made. That avoids you basing it on what they wrote, because that would be a bit awkward. They write something, then you get to write a response, and then that's the end of the conversation. That doesn't work out so well. We need you to both write your version of events kind of independently, and then we'll work it out. Right. I'm scrolling through. No, I've made it to the event section. I think we're done. So I'm sorry for skimming over a few bits towards the end there. The streaming problems earlier definitely they left me with some issues. I'm finishing half an hour later now than I ordinarily would, but thank you for sticking with me. I will do my absolute best to bring you layers next week. If you do have any questions, let me know in the chat just now. But for those of you who are not watching this live or watching a recorded version of this, thank you for tuning in and see you soon. Bye bye for this episode.